And did you know that you can have greater exposure to these chemicals by taking hot showers than when you drink the water? That's because many chemicals are inhaled when they evaporate, and others are absorbed through the skin. The KDF shower filter is designed to reduce chlorine, lead, mercury, and iron, and it inhibits the growth of bacteria, mold, algae, and fungus in your shower. The media is non-toxic, environmentally sound, and is recyclable. The KDF shower filter will typically last 10,000 gallons or 1 year, whichever comes first. Hospitals, restaurants, and water treatment facilities use this media to reduce chlorine, iron, heavy metals, and bacteria. What about you? Order your KDF shower filter, normally $49, for our special price of only $35, a $14 savings. Call now to order at 1-888-803-4438.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and, well, to this hour, they're going to be the views of Joseph C. Smith, Jr., who, along with Tara Ross, has written a book called Under God, George Washington and the Question of Church and State, and, of course, Joseph Smith is a graduate of Yale College and the University of Chicago Law School. He's a former Deputy Attorney General of the state of Colorado, and he's currently practicing law in Colorado, but they've done a wonderful job of going into George Washington's writings. And is there really a wall of separation between church and state? Why, if certainly our Supreme Court opens its sessions on a daily basis when the crier comes in and says, God bless the United States in this honorable court. God bless the United States in this honorable court. Why in heaven's name would the Supreme Court take God out of our schools and God out of, and reference to God and Christianity out of every public place, and even forbid the Ten Commandments to be posted in our schools? And yet, of course, there's replicas of them all over the Supreme Court, above in the brief above where the justices sit on the door to the, or just outside the door to the Supreme Court, on the front of the Supreme Court building. Our whole foundation of our law is built upon the Ten Commandments. So why then would the Supreme Court take God and any mention of God out of our schools? And the question is, what did George Washington feel about that? Mr. Smith, thank you so very much for being with us. Mr. Smith, are you there?
Actually, he's not there, but I am, Dr.
Smith. All right, fine. Is this Joseph Smith?
No, this is Will Grigg.
Oh, Will Grigg. I'm sorry. I guess maybe we have him tomorrow. Well, all right, fine. Then you go right ahead, William, and I won't have to introduce Mr. Smith tomorrow. You go right ahead.
Oh, hey. Well, I'd like to hear Mr. Smith talk about that subject as well, because that's one that really comes to the heart of the main problem we have today in politics, and that is the fact that people don't understand that government is supposed to be subordinate to God. When you have a government that displaces God, or people who want to remove the proper place, remove God from the proper place in our priorities, you end up with a state that claims to exercise the powers of God. And go back to the 18th century and the writings of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He was the fellow who was the chief philosopher of the French Revolution. He created this concept called the civil religion, in which it really didn't matter what it was that the state ordered people to worship. The important thing was that the state would be in charge of dictating the content of people's worship and requiring that people profess to believe the tenets of the state-imposed civil religion, and that once people were compelled to make that profession of faith, if they acted in a way which was contrary to the dictates of the state, they would be in a position of forfeiting their lives. Rousseau, like unbelievers of a particularly militant type throughout history, I really believe that what was important was that the government used this specific religion as a way of regimenting the lives of people so that they would be able to be kept docile and harmless, and the elites would be able to carry out their schemes for the perfection of mankind. And the civil religion, in one form or another, informed every totalitarian order of government from the French Revolution of 1789. You had the enthronement of reason, the worship of the supreme being, and all the way through the Nazi and Soviet tyrannies of the 20th century. And unfortunately, we have our own type of civic religion today that is not as overtly totalitarian as those previous examples, but it's just as bad in principle.
Amen to that. Well, you hang on here. We're going to actually bring on some other guests here, other stations, and so we'll just repeat a little of what you were saying right here at Radio Liberty. Hang on. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. William Grigg, who was formerly the senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now is doing a lot of writing. He's written a new book called The Eclipse of Liberty, which incidentally we carry, going into the fact that we're moving away from freedom towards a police state here in the United States. And of course, William is kind enough to come onto our program a couple of times a week to share really his views on what's going on, and he writes a blog. We'll tell you later how to get his material, but it's excellent material, and he is, of course, solidly based in an understanding and a love for our country, which is being, of course, taken away from us by people who have a different view because they worship a different God, because, of course, they really are dedicated to the idea of a one-world government. They're dedicated to the idea of a one-world religion with the destruction of Christianity and the enthronement of a new world leader. The ideas, of course, which were laid out so carefully by Plato in his Republic. But, William, you pick up the story now. And, of course, the people did not hear what you said previously, so don't be afraid to repeat yourself.
Well, I was talking about this concept of the civil religion or civic religion, which was really set out in detail by Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the 1700s in his book The Social Contract. And the whole idea behind the civic religion, bearing in mind that Jean-Jacques Rousseau was an unbeliever, he was what we now call sort of a transcendental humanist in many respects, was the idea that it didn't really matter what it was that people worshipped as long as the state was in charge of dictating the content of their religious belief. Once the state had established the articles of public faith, people would be required to profess fealty to the state and loyalty to its religious tenets. And then after that period, if they were caught behaving as if they did not believe what they had been forced to profess, then they would be subject to having their lives forfeit. And that was pretty much the idea that was followed by the Jacobins who made the French Revolution from 1789 to roughly 1799. The idea that the government should be in charge of managing every aspect of people's lives because there were no limits to its jurisdiction. And there were two separate civil religions that were imposed on formerly Catholic France during the Revolution. The first was the worship of reason. That was seen as too diffuse and too abstract. And so they decided that they would have in its place the worship of the Supreme Being. And the Supreme Being was left conveniently undefined, except for the fact that it was obviously not the Supreme Being revealed in the Bible. You could believe anything other than believing in the God of the Bible. And they went so far as to attack the Christian calendar. They did away with the Christian calendar because the advent of Jesus Christ and the
Hold that thought. We'll be back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William was just talking about what life was like there in France after the French Revolution in 1789, and how, of course, everything was designed to destroy Christianity. Certainly, they seized the lands of the Catholic Church. They hung or guillotined many of the nuns, many of the priests. And then, of course, they even changed the calendar because, of course, the traditional calendar was dated from the birth of Christ.
Yeah.
And because of their intense hatred of Christianity, which was the very foundation of the Jacobin movement, which, of course, was now, of course, the Illuminati. And if you doubt that, we have a wonderful book, which we carry, called Fire in the Minds of Men, which was actually written by James H. Billington, the Librarian of Congress, who will tell you everything I'm telling you. The Jacobins were simply a front for the Illuminati, which was simply a continuation of these beliefs of the ancient mystery religions, all aimed at creating a world revolution. So you pick up the story there.
Well, the world revolution that Billington describes was transmitted through this tradition that began with the French Revolution, where you have this occultic movement in the Illuminati that diffused in what Billington refers to as the diaspora of the Illuminist movement. By the 19th century, it had gained institutional solidity in the form of a number of movements that were built on the same principles and followed the same conspiratorial methods in countries throughout Europe, and then were exported to the United States and the New World. And all these movements were based on this religious idea of the state as the representation of the divine idea in the world. George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, the German philosopher, actually devoted a lot of time and attention to developing the idea that the state, the institutionalized coercion that we refer to as government, is the embodiment of God's will in the world. And the state is actually God walking on the earth. And you could find that idea becoming commingled with certain nationalist movements. This is something that Billington does talk about at great length in Fire in the Minds of Men. It sort of became commingled with a lot of nationalist movements in Italy and Germany. And one result of that, of course, was what we call fascism. Fascism is not, as many people believe, a type of right-wing hyper-conservatism. Fascism is the cult of the state, and the cult of the state in National Socialist Germany was all bound up with this idea of pagan Teutonic collectivism. In Italy, it wasn't quite as acute as what you saw in National Socialist Germany, but you still had this idea that the state, although it was not explicitly racist in the same sense, the philosophy wasn't as explicitly racist as the Nazi philosophy. In fascist Italy, you have the state being in charge of everything. Everything within the state, nothing outside the state, nothing against the state, was Mussolini's formula. Here in the United States, in the late 19th century, you had this movement that was called the Social Gospel that sought in a milder and perhaps a little bit more humanitarian way to get people bound up with the idea that the government had some kind of a divine function, and they were trying to redefine the terms of Christian belief to where the state was seen as, in some sense, an instrument for the outworking of God's purposes in the world. And this seems to be innocuous enough to people until they think about it for a second in terms of what Jesus said our true loyalty should be. You know, render unto Caesar only that which is Caesar's, is what the parable really tells us. And render to God that which is God. God doesn't have any limits on his jurisdiction. God is sovereign over everything. The state exists to carry out only certain limited functions, and the state's authority is always contingent and revocable. That's the fundamental American idea. We don't have a civic religion. We have a situation where we recognize God's sovereignty, which is why George Washington, who has been misrepresented in history as a deist or a humanist, somebody who didn't really believe in God's intervening sovereignty in the affairs of man, when he took the oath of office, he extemporized the prayer, "So help me God." He was asking for God's assistance to carry out the terms of this covenant that he was making, to have true faith and to display sound stewardship as the first president of this newly created constitutional republic. There are plenty of accounts, they're by no means spurious, of George Washington actively praying for God's favorable intervention in our war for independence. Even somebody who was by no means what I'd consider a traditional Christian, namely Benjamin Franklin, made that famous speech in the Constitutional Convention about the fact that during the war for independence, God did intervene on our behalf, and he did exercise his influence on behalf of the cause of human freedom as embodied in our revolution. These are not the sorts of things that deists would say. Deists believe that there is, as John Adams famously quipped about Unitarianism, that they believe that there is at most one God, and that the entity called God created a universe that operates on the basis of Newtonian physics. He wound it up and let it run and doesn't bother with it. That's the deistic point of view. George Washington didn't believe that. Thomas Jefferson didn't believe that. I tremble for my nation when I think that God is just. That's what Jefferson said about slavery. That's not the expression that would fall from the lips of a deist, nor would Ben Franklin's invocation of prayer and divine intercession come from the soul of somebody who was a deist. So these people were steeped in the idea that God does intervene in the affairs of man, that we're accountable to him, both as individuals and as stewards when we're given delegated power. And they understood that the purpose of government must be to protect God-given liberty and thereby to glorify the Creator. It's a completely different worldview from the civil religion that Rousseau talked about, and then the revolutionary faith that the Illuminist movement and its offshoots all promoted, that wrought horror and devastation and bloodshed and tyranny and totalitarianism for centuries. But the problem is that there was this other strain in the American culture that the social gospel represented that started to look at the state as if it were some kind of a divine entity. And that was the movement that was broadly analogous to the Fabian socialist movement in England, that was inspired and influenced by some of the theosophical movements that sprang up in the 19th century, that were based on the idea of either transvaluating Christianity, replacing the values and principles and doctrines of biblical Christianity with a different set of content, using the symbols and the language of Christianity to promote a different worldview on the one hand, or simply making pitched battle against it on the other. And by the time World War I rolled around and our nation became involved in World War I through the machinations of people who were inspired by this perverse worldview, there was a great deal of receptivity, even in mainstream Christianity, for tenets that even a century earlier would have been properly identified as heresies, a heretical belief about the sanctity of the state and how the state is in some sense a divinely ordained entity, as opposed to being something men created in the effort to do that which God would expect of us. You know, somehow the state itself was divine. And I can't really get into the details. There's a wonderful book about it called The War for Righteousness, which was written by a wonderfully insightful author and published 5 or 10 years ago. He talks about the fact that this so-called progressive Christianity was really instrumental in getting us involved in World War I and also involved in the social revolution that brought us all these horrible things that are destroying our economy and our culture right now, including the movement on behalf of the Federal Reserve, the movement on behalf of income tax. They brought us alcohol prohibition, which got the government involved in regulating the content of the bloodstream of American citizens. And since that time, there's always been this assumption that really, when you think about it, the state should be involved in helping to mold the souls of citizens. It shouldn't merely be protecting citizens from the criminal acts of the lawless, but it should be involved in a redemptive function in human affairs. And that's just simply not constitutional, and it is utterly unbiblical as well.
I think it's so important for people to understand that the Christian religion has been infiltrated, in my estimation, by people from the other side for many years. Of course, one of the major forces behind the Federal Council of Churches was John Foster Dulles, who certainly was not a Christian. Alan Dulles, they were part of this globalist movement deeply tied into the occult. But if they could get into Christianity and begin to use Christianity for their own purposes, that they could convince, of course, the good Christians that they should never oppose what the government did. After all, what does it say in Romans 13? Doesn't it say that we're to simply to obey whatever the government did? Didn't God give us this government? And I would like to suggest God did not give us this government. And they will tell you things were corrupt in Rome, and they certainly were. And in Paul's day, he wanted people to be, not to try to overthrow the government, but God gave us a Christian republic. And the wicked people, of course, have taken it away and replaced it with a participatory democracy that is leading us from war to war to war. And we should try to get back to the government God gave us. And Christians have an obligation, rather than, of course, be misled, as they were in Hitler's Germany, into following the dictates of Romans 13. If you haven't read the book Hitler's Cross by Erwin Lutzer, let me recommend that.
Yes.
It is a wonderful book because he tells you, Erwin Lutzer, senior pastor at the Moody Bible Church in Chicago, will tell you that Adolf Hitler had the ministers go around preaching Romans 13 so they would follow the dictatorship and they would follow his lead into war. And that's just what's going on in our churches in America today. Go right ahead, William.
Yes, the name of that book is The War for Righteousness, Progressive Christianity, the Great War, meaning World War I, and the Rise of the Messianic Nation by Richard M. Gamble. And Richard Gamble is assistant professor of history at Palm Beach Atlantic University in West Palm Beach, Florida. That book came out about 10 years ago. It's already out of print, but it should be available through interlibrary loan. As a matter of fact, I got my copy as a remainder book through interlibrary loan. There was a library that wanted to get rid of it, which is a scandal, a fairly familiar type of scandal, because this is an incredibly insightful book, and one that goes into great detail talking about the way that many elements of what we perceive to be the conservative Christian right today are direct descendants of the so-called progressive Christian movement of the early 1900s, which deified the state, which is a form of idolatry that eventually killed millions.
Amen to that. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment. Our guest is William Grigg. And, of course, William Grigg has a blog site. He does a lot of radio. Certainly his latest book, The Eclipse of Liberty, available from Radio Liberty. But you must understand, behind everything that's happening politically are these powerful spiritual forces, of course, trying to use Christianity for their own purposes. We'll be right back. William, go ahead, pick up the story.
Sure. When we talk about the idea of deifying the state, and we talk about the misuse, the deliberate, dishonest misrepresentation of Romans chapter 13, you have to recognize that Romans chapter 13 does talk about the idea that authorities are established by God. But in the context of a republic, which is to say a country that is ruled by law, the law itself is king. That's something that Thomas Paine, who was by no means a conventional Christian, said in Common Sense. But that's the operative principle in a republic. In a republic, the law is king. And so when you read the Bible verses that talk about sustaining the authorities, supporting the authorities, and recognizing that authorities come from God, that is to say, authorities are all subordinate to God because all power in heaven and earth was given to Jesus Christ. That's what you read right in Matthew 28 before the Great Commission. When you read those passages, you have to understand that in our system, we're all governed by law, both citizens and those to whom we delegate authority. What that means, actually, is that in the scheme of things, the President of the United States, the members of Congress and the Senate, everybody who exercises any kind of civic authority in our culture is our agent. They're not our superiors. They're not our sovereigns. The law is sovereign. We've given them power. We exist in a lateral or a horizontal relationship with these people. We're all under God's authority, and God's authority, in political terms, has infused and informed our Constitution. And I've had this conversation on many occasions with many people I regard to be brothers and sisters in the Lord who would come down on me with great passion and vehemence when I would criticize various aspects of what George W. Bush has done, George W. Bush being a conspicuously a professed Christian. So we have to understand that you're violating your responsibility as a Christian, I am told, because I am criticizing him in a way that undermines his authority. And don't you know that the authorities are established by God? And when you're daring to criticize George W. Bush in those terms, it's like you're lifting up your hand against the Lord's anointed, which, of course, is the most perfect nonsense. George W. Bush is my employee. I don't get people reading me the riot act if I say that somebody from whom I contract services, for instance, to paint my house has done a bad job. He's my employee. If I go to a restaurant and I criticize the performance of the cook or the waiter, I'm not lifting up my hand against the Lord's anointed. I'm criticizing somebody with whom I have a contractual relationship. Well, the same type of thing exists with respect to George W. Bush. He's not my sovereign. He's not my leader. That's another misnomer here. The president is not our leader. The president is somebody who's supposed to execute the constitutionally appropriate laws of Congress to represent the United States in certain diplomatic functions, to appoint certain constitutional officers. And when our military is called into the service of the United States by Congress through a declaration of war, the president is the commander-in-chief under the supervision of Congress, because Congress still has the power to establish regulations governing the armed forces and to appropriate money. The presidency is a very, very modest office when you take a look at those powers which were given to it by men careful not to create a monarch. And so when you understand that, you understand that the presidency itself is supposed to be an office of relatively few powers, very carefully defined, it's not supposed to be something akin to this grandiose divine emperor kingship that we now see, where the President of the United States is seen as a quasi-divine figure, because he presides over this state. That's the real problem with this idolatrous attachment that we get to the political state here.
William, hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment. It's Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course William was simply pointing out that under our form of government, the executive, the president, his job was to simply execute or carry out the laws that were laid out by the Congress, and he, of course, if we went to war, he would be the commander-in-chief, but Congress would have to declare war, Congress would have to appropriate money for the war, and Congress was the most powerful, of course, of all of the branches of government, but even their power was limited by the 10th Amendment, which said that the powers not specifically herein granted to the Congress are to be limited to the states and to the people. But what has happened here in the United States, of course, is the executive is seizing all power. The president, of course, has signing statements where he says, well, I'm signing this legislation passed by Congress, but I will not enforce it. I refuse to. I am in charge. And, of course, when it comes to torture, it's all right. I've deemed it's all right. Torture's all right. We can certainly go ahead and invade any country if we want to, as long as we think it's necessary. We don't have to be threatened by those countries. Those of you who didn't see Deb Fife's interview on 60 Minutes on Sunday, we really need to at least read the text of that. It's up on the Internet under 60 Minutes, CBS 60 Minutes, Douglas Fife. And he simply says, we didn't go into Iraq because we thought that they had weapons of mass destruction. Nobody thought that. The reason we went in is because we thought that maybe sometime in the future they might attack us, so we wanted to attack them first. Where does the president get the right to attack anybody he wants to? And this is what the number three man in the Defense Department said at the time. We have an imperial presidency that is not answerable to Congress, that is not answerable to the people. And, of course, this is a frightening thing to contemplate. Go right ahead, William.
Yeah, it is a terrifying thing to contemplate, and it's a terrifying thing to live under. It's been gestating for about a century or so, and I think that it reached its term and was born in the full flower of its malignancy after September 11th. A lot of conservatives back during the Clinton period would point out a couple of things, first of which is that Mr. Clinton was never constrained to do that which the Constitution required, and he, in the second term of his presidency, became quite enamored of ruling by decree, and conservatives thought, quite appropriately, I was among them, that this was a form of dictatorial abuse of power. And now we have the spectacle of George W. Bush being told by his advisors, among them John C. Yoo, the former general counsel there at the Office of Legal Counsel for the White House, that the powers of what he calls the war presidency, or the commander-in-chief power of the presidency, is essentially limitless, and that he is not restrained by treaties, by the text of the Constitution, by the will of Congress, or by any power apart from his own sovereign will, which is why, if the president deems fit to do so, he can order the sexual torture of innocent children as a tactic in the war on terror. I simply cannot imagine how anybody who has a scintilla of human decency could imagine, much less openly endorse the idea, that a president could order the sexual torture of children. We know what Jesus said about that subject. People who say and believe such things should be fitted for millstones. But that's a good example of where we're led when we invest fallen, corrupt men of any variety, of any background, with basically limitless power and complete impunity. And it's my belief, not many people would agree with this perhaps, but it's my belief that if you take a look at the history of the ancient Israelites, and you see that prior to the advent of King Saul, they had, once they had settled in the Promised Land, the advantage of living in a very loose confederacy of tribes without a formal government. I believe that they repudiated that blessing. We read about how they demanded that we have a king so that we could go to war, basically, like every other nation. And the Bible says that God, through Samuel, understood that to be, and described at the time, that demand by the Israelites to be a rejection of God's law, so he gave them what they wanted. They had a participatory democracy after a fashion. They democratically, if you will, chose to surrender the advantage of living as free people in this loose confederation, and they chose despotism under a monarch because they wanted to be like every other nation. Well, in a way, the history of the United States has been sort of similar. I mean, our founding fathers were very conscious of the idea that the trajectory of the country, the republic they were forming, would emulate in some ways the history of the Israelites in the Old Testament. Some of them wanted to make Hebrew one of our official languages, as a matter of fact.
I think people need to go back and read 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter. That's
yes.
1 Samuel, the 8th chapter. And the story is, you know, is there. It's just exactly as William has laid it out. And, of course, when Samuel went to the Lord and said, look, the people, they want a king. And the Lord said, Samuel, it's not that they've rejected you. It's that they've rejected me. But give them a king, but tell them what it'll mean. I mean, the king will take 10% of whatever they have. He'll have, of course, their sons and daughters running beside his chariots in war. He'll have your sons and daughters working in his fields. But give them a king, because, of course, they've rejected me. And that's just what we're doing here in America. We're rejecting the government God gave us for what we have today.
Well, it's interesting.
Okay, fine. Well, you go right ahead with him.
It's interesting you bring up the 8th chapter of Samuel, because I happen to have that in front of me in the version found in the Living Bible, which is a modern paraphrase. It follows the content, but it paraphrases it to be more conversational in terms of the text. And the way that it's phrased here in the Living Bible version of 1 Samuel chapter 8 is the following. If you insist on having a king, the Lord said, he will conscript your sons, which I find really interesting. Conscript your sons. That's a big issue, and it has to be a big issue right now when we're talking about the possibility of a return to conscription. The first conscription act that was passed in modern America, I mean, there was a conscription measure that was passed halfway through the war between the states. Both sides of the war between the states, regrettably, ended up using conscription as a way to supply manpower. But back in July of 1863, when the Conscription Act went through for the Union government, there was a New York Times editorial that said in so many words that the logic of conscription, the logic of a draft, is that the government is entitled to every right arm and every last dollar for its own defense. Now think of that for just a second. We're told that the purpose of government, if there's any excuse for this thing we call government, it is that it exists to protect us, to protect the law-abiding from lawless violence, from whether you're talking about street gangs, whether you're talking about predatory foreign governments. That's when we have a government. But conscription completely inverts that order of priorities by making people, putting people at the disposal of the government for the government's defense. And it's a form of human sacrifice in a very real way. What you're talking about here is that you have this quasi-religious obligation to sacrifice yourself, your time, talents, and all you possess, and your very lives, if necessary, to government in order to protect the holy government. That's the fundamental blood ritual of the idolatrous state is conscription in whatever form, whether it's in terms of conquering foreign countries and using them as using their soldiers and their subjects as sacrificial fodder. I mean, my Aztec ancestors specialized in that type of thing. Or when you're talking about levy and mas, like they had in the French Revolution during their civil religion, during the reign of their civil religion, that resulted in conscription, and you had a group of people in an area called Lavanda, or Lavandais in France, traditional Catholics who rebelled against this, and they didn't worship at the government-approved churches. They didn't allow their children to go to the government-dominated school system. When the government in Paris said that they were going to start conscripting people to go abroad to fight other Catholic nations in Europe.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. My guest is William Grigg. And before we go on with the discussion, William, I'd like you to tell our listeners how they can get your blog site and get your material.
I appreciate that. The easiest way to find my blog, which is called Pro Libertate, Latin phrase that means for freedom, is to go to the website of the Welch Foundation, which is called The Right Source. The web address for that is www.rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, rightsourceonline.com. At the top of the page, there's an advertisement for my book, Liberty in Eclipse, the War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. You can order that directly from the website, or you can go to Radio Liberty and order it from Dr. Stan. But if you go to the RightSource website, once again, rightsourceonline.com, scroll down the front page, the front screen of that website, look at the left-hand side of your screen, you'll find my photograph, and there's a link to my blog, which is called Pro Libertate. I update it between 3 and 5 times a week. As a matter of fact, Dr. Stan, I just updated it about a half an hour before I came on the radio with you. And the purpose of my blog, apart from the therapeutic purposes it serves for me, I have to have some kind of a forum to complain about what's going on, is to infuriate people and to terrify people usefully. I don't want to leave people infuriated to the point where they can't think straight. I want to infuriate them to the point where they do think straight. I don't want to terrify people into paralysis. I want to terrify people into action. I want to provoke people that way. And so I'm constantly writing about the subject that I think is of paramount importance in human affairs, and that's the issue of human liberty and the threats to it. And unfortunately, as we've discussed on many occasions, and as we've been talking about this afternoon, the government that rules us right now is the most powerful of its kind in history. It is the most corrupt of its kind in history. And it is very rapidly becoming the most tyrannical of its kind in history. We've yet to reach the depths which were limned by Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia or Maoist China. But the government that rules us right now, in every relevant principled detail, is claiming the same kinds of powers as those antecedents. And if present trends continue much longer, it's going to become more overtly tyrannical than it is right now. It's already overtly tyrannical. Anybody who goes to an airport now is required to pass through the type of multi-layered, invasive, degrading, dehumanizing security apparatus that I had to go through in 1985 when I visited Fort Leavenworth as a musical performer. You had to go in Fort Leavenworth through a gauntlet, a security gauntlet that had everything but a strip search. You had to provide government-provided ID. You had to go through an invasive background search. And once you were in order to get out, you had to do the same thing. When I was in Guatemala in 1983, following a military coup that overthrew the government, when I lived under martial law for a number of months, the environment in the country was very similar to what we felt immediately after 9/11 and can still feel today in many locations. And the trend line is not favorable, and things will only get worse from here unless we do something to arrest what's going on, to recover that which has been stolen from us. And the reason why I call the book Liberty and Eclipse, I never tire of explaining, is because an eclipse is a passing thing. It's my hope that the phase we're going through right now is a passing thing. We know that an eclipse will correct itself. However, the eclipse of our liberty will not correct itself automatically. That's something that we're going to have to bring about with God's help.
I certainly agree with you, and that it's an excellent book. We recommend it to you. Well, you go ahead. You were talking certainly about what's going on in our society, and of course, certainly what had happened in the Jewish society, you know, when, of course, people said they wanted a king, and yet today we have almost a royal executive branch of government. We have a president who is not answerable to the public, is not answerable to Congress. Congress refuses, of course, to take any action. People voted for the Democrats in year 2006 because they thought, they honestly thought they were going to get us out of Iraq. Of course, they should have realized that both parties are controlled by exactly the same people, and it doesn't really make a dime's worth of difference whether you have the Republicans or the Democrats there. The Republicans have been in charge for 6 years. They control both houses of the legislature. They control the presidency. And all they had to do was pass by a simple majority a law that said we're going to do away with abortion. It will not be allowed. At least the federal government will have nothing to do with it. We'll return to the states the right to determine whether abortion is legal or not. And they absolutely refused to do it. They could have done it. They could have negated the Supreme Court decision by simply imposing Article 3, Section 2. They did not do it. George Bush talks a good line. But, of course, he takes money away from one international organization that supports abortion and gives it to another organization that supports abortion. And the Christians are out there all applauding. Look at what a wonderful president we have. And it's all smoke and mirrors. But, of course, nobody ever tells the people that, and certainly our Christian leaders don't tell them, that George Bush is about as pro-life as Bill Clinton. But go right ahead.
Yeah, and the Clinton the Clinton family, that is to say Bill and Hillary, and I would leave Chelsea out of it, she's a non-combatant, but they're very close to the Bushes. You can actually see photographs of Bill Clinton bowing before George Bush the Elder as if George Bush were in some sense his liege lord. And you can see photographs of the two George Bushes in, and Bill Clinton in company together at, I believe, at the dedication of the Bill Clinton Presidential Museum, where they're very convivial with each other. I mean, they share most of the same interests and appetites and aptitudes and certainly the same objectives. To take the conversation out of the ethereal realm and talk about it in terms of partisan political applications here, I do think that most people misunderstand the fundamental nature of the party system that we have right now. We don't have two parties that are in any sense opposites or even contrasting approaches to what's going on. We basically have two parties which are functionally interchangeable. As Carol Quigley said 40 years ago in Tragedy and Hope, they should be so nearly identical that you can throw the bums out with metronomic regularity and install the other party, and you will not have any discontinuities in policy, whether you're talking about foreign affairs or domestic applications of government policy. And so that's the stage we're at right now. The only big difference between the two parties is that they play to slightly different constituencies, slightly different clusters of interest groups. The Democrats tend to play to unions, particularly teachers' unions, and the unions really are sort of a dying breed, but they still have a lot of political clout. They also tend to truckle to the elderly, to people who are on the receiving end of transfer payments of a small type, like welfare subsidies, things of that sort. They have a whole constellation, I'm tempted to say menagerie, of ethnic grievance lobbies that are very much attached to the Democratic Party. And so they tend to pitch their political program in a way that is palatable to that cluster of interest groups, whereas the Republican Party tends to have, at least in terms of the presidential primary season, tends to have a very large variety of nominally Christian pressure groups and interest groups. And it's interesting, most of these groups, of course, cluster right around the imperial capital in Washington, D.C., along the K Street lobbyist boutique avenue, or you take a look at the immediate environments in places like Virginia. All these groups are hovering right around the imperial capital so that they can bask in the reflected glory of our imperial government and do its bidding, and they have networks throughout the country of people who look to Washington for their solutions, including the so-called limited government groups that all take the directions from Washington, which is, of course, a paradox. None of them really stops to examine in any detail. But in the Republican Party, you have the pro-life movement, you have the pro-family movement generally, you have people who are, for reasons that defy understanding, animated primarily by the desire to make sure that the military-industrial complex remains as big as it is. And so they're eager and ready and willing to take up the cudgels against whoever Washington decides is the enemy du jour. And in the Republican Party, of course, you have a very large influence from politically favored corporations who promote the agenda of corporatism, which is to say government subsidy of business, big business in various ways, and so-called free trade agreements that are actually regulated trade agreements that work to the benefit of these politically connected corporations.
Well, of course, don't forget, of course, the defense lobby, because we have to defend ourselves against the wicked communists who we're financing. We've financed communists since its inception, and yet, of course, they say we've got to have a powerful defense against communism.
Yeah.
And, of course, then, of course, the group that wants to cut taxes. Well, we're all in favor of cutting taxes, but they want to cut taxes and increase spending. The Republicans supposedly stand for limited government and a balanced budget. They've given us the biggest deficits of all time, and certainly George Bush has given us certainly more spending than any other president we've ever had. And the largest deficits, both trade deficits and certainly federal deficits or government deficits. And, I mean, see, nothing as it appears to be, and yet there are an awful lot of people who honestly think that the Republican Party stands for what it says it stands for, or the Democratic Party stands for what it says it stands for, and the truth is, it is all a mirage, it's smoke and mirrors, so that you think you have a choice when you go to the polls, but believe me, of course, when you go, and especially with the electronic voting machines, doesn't matter how you vote, It's who counts the votes. It's important.
Yeah.
They're all riggable. The Secretary of State here in California actually had all of the electronic voting machines come take it, examined, and they were all, of course, can be programmed, and they all can be simply scammed. And so why do we bother to vote if it's a corrupt system? Why aren't the people incensed? Why, we're told by our Christian leaders, just go along. God gave you this government. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think God put the current government in any more than he put the Clintons into power. I believe the establishment did, and they worship a different God. Go right ahead.
They certainly do, and I think it's something very perilously akin to taking God's name in vain to blame him for the government that rules us right now. We did this to ourselves, just as the ancient Israelites did it to themselves when they demanded that God believe them of having the blessing of living in that diffuse confederacy of tribes, and they demanded that God give them the kings. You know, H.M. Mencken once said that democracy is that theory of government that says that the people know what they want, deserve to get it good and hard. Well, that's pretty much the democratic approach that God took when the Israelites demanded that they have a king. All right, if you want it, I'll give them to you. I'll tell you up front what's going to happen. I'll give you a last chance to decide if this is what you really want. They said that's what they really want. They soon had that. And with the advent of kingship, they ended up with an incredibly corrupt system under Solomon toward the end of his life. And then it split into two, and you had all of the delights of internecine warfare coupled with all the delights of oppressive taxes and tyranny. And that's what we've had now, as we've seen our country forsake its Republican heritage and embrace this mass socialist corporatist system that rules us right now. And these two branches, really, we don't have two parties so much as we have two appendages of the same bird of prey. Somebody once said that the two parties, I believe it was Butler Schaefer, who said that the two major parties are really just wings of the same bird of prey. And if you take a look at the military-industrial complex, which you brought up, Dr. Stan, it's interesting. There was a report from the Center for Responsive Politics that came out about a week ago documenting that in terms of individual stock portfolios, the members of Congress have in the aggregate something like $196 million invested in the military-industrial sector.
And so why should they want to end the war? They're making a lot of money off their stocks, which are invested in, of course. And
where your heart is, there, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Right. And they've invested their treasure in warfare. Even somebody like John Kerry, who was the other bonesman, the other skull and bones acolyte in 2004, ran against bonesman George W. Bush, his stock portfolio reportedly includes $38 million in investments in the warfare sector. And so when you have the spectacle of General Petraeus, you know, he who must be obeyed, he whose name must not be taken in vain, according to the Washington punditocracy, talking about the fact that, we're just going to have to slow down our withdrawal from Iraq and think in terms of a longer commitment, that's money and, if you'll, music and money to the ears of his audience on Capitol Hill. And then just a couple of days ago, we read in the Guardian of London about this status of forces agreement in Iraq, excuse me, the draft status of forces agreement in Iraq doesn't have any details or any intimation that we will ever be removing our troops from Iraq, which of course plays right into the logic of what John McCain said about how we might be there for 100 years. You've got to figure if we still have American troops garrisoned in the middle of a unified Germany. We still have them in Japan, in Okinawa. We still have them scattered throughout Western Europe, and we're moving NATO eastward into the former Warsaw Pact region long after the putative end of the so-called Cold War. It stands to reason that decades from now we're still going to have troops bogged down in Mesopotamia, so assuming, of course, that we still have the financial means to keep them there. And that's the other element of this whole story that shows the tangible cost of idolatry here, is that we're at the point now where something is going to break very soon, and some other architecture of power is going to have to replace this U.S.-centric hegemonic system that has been bearing sway now for about a decade and a half or two decades, because, quite frankly, we're broke in a way that no society has ever been broke before. And I can't help but suspect that what's going to happen is that we're going to be driven into some kind of really overt and obvious receivership within a few years, with some other multinational arrangement taking over for the United States. John McCain gave an address last week where he was talking about this idea that has been mooted about by some of the really outlying neocons of having a council of democracies that would sort of be a supplement to, or perhaps even a successor to, the United Nations. And it would be the vessel of the same degenerate idea, the same old Tower of Babel scenario of uniting nations that should be separate and independent under one authority for the purpose of managing global affairs. That's something that might happen. Forgive me, that might be the next wrinkle that we'll see on that old idea.
Well, I really think that, first of all, we're really seeing today, and people don't understand, is the fulfillment of Nimrod's plan as he built the Tower of Babel, which was to control the world, and it was to dominate the world, and God intervened and caused the people to speak different languages. But if you go to Strasbourg today, you'll actually see a replica of the incomplete Tower of Babel. In fact, over in Europe today, they often will have these pictures that show the incomplete Tower of Babel. And, of course, that was what the symbol of the European Union was.
Yeah.
And, of course, now, of course, they built the building where the Parliament meets as a replica of an incomplete building. Of course, it's completed, but it's the replica of the incomplete Tower of Babel. Behind everything going on today are the same powerful spirits and forces that motivated Nimrod and are motivating the leaders of our world today. And they work through covert organizations. The Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, the Club of Rome, the Masons, the Lucius Trust, the Rosicrucians, certainly the Theosophists, and a myriad of other secret and semi-secret organizations. And, of course, nobody's going to tell you what they're really up to. What do they want? They want the destruction of America, the impoverishment of our people. They want to impose a new world religion and a new world government. Our guest is William Greig. We're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up today's program right here at Radio Liberty. Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, Dr. Stan, you've mentioned on a couple of occasions how important the Earth Charter is, this document that was co-created by Maurice Strong of Canada, Stephen C. Rockefeller, and Mikhail Gorbachev. I've interviewed two of those men. I've interviewed Rockefeller and Gorbachev, and just a week or so ago, maybe a couple of weeks ago, there was a news item in which Mikhail Gorbachev is claiming to be a Christian. Now, I don't happen to believe that's true. I wish it were true. I hope it would be true, because I would like to see all people become believers in Christ and be redeemed by him. But the man's actions suggest to me that that's simply not the case. But I do think it's interesting that before the end of his reign, before the Soviet Union was wound down in 1991 and this new Russian Federation was sent in as a replacement, Gorbachev proclaimed, I believe it was 1991, as the year of Blavatsky, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, the founder of the Theosophical Society in 1875, the purpose of that organization being to destroy Christianity and to destroy the monotheistic idea. And Mikhail Gorbachev, of course, was for many decades of his life a Leninist, a disciple of Lenin, somebody who professed to believe in the ultimate fulfillment of the Marxist goal of a world government ruled by socialist principles. I think that what's going to happen is that we're going to see in the coming years a particular drive to to infuse modern Christianity with the tenets of the Earth Charter, and that Gorbachev is probably going to come out of his obscurity and lead the effort to evangelize on behalf of what he calls a Ten Commandments for the Environment. We're already seeing the Ark of Hope make some tours, and people make pilgrimages to see the Ark of Hope. That's the vessel containing, blasphemously titled vessel containing this Earth Charter. It'll be interesting to see what will happen in a few years when people are going to be looking for something to provide them with hope amid the terrible times that are about to befall us. And I wouldn't be surprised to see Gorbachev have a late life renaissance as an important figure promoting that perverted gospel.
And of course, he is really one of the leaders of the world today, and anybody who doubts that, you only need to see the people who attended his 1995 State of the World Forum meeting. We'll be glad to send those copies of that who attended the meeting to anyone. There's George Shultz, James Baker III, George Herbert Walker Bush, simply Mbeki, who then later would become the president of South Africa, the leaders of the world paying homage to Mikhail Gorbachev. A Christian? Well, of course, you need to read Wayne Peterson's book, Extraordinary People, Extraordinary Times, and, of course, to find out where Gorbachev's spiritual foundation really is. William, we're out of time. God bless. Thanks so much.
God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We hope that you enjoyed William Craig. He's a frequent guest on Radio Liberty. We have him on every Friday at 9 o'clock in the evening Pacific time. And certainly I would want to mention that if you have shortwave, we have an evening program, 8 o'clock Pacific time, 11 o'clock Eastern time, at 5.875 or 6.110. You can get either one of those two frequencies, 5.875 or 6.110, and listen to our program from 8 to 9 Pacific time, 11 to 12 Eastern time. And, of course, those frequencies come in very well at that time of night. So we hope that you'll listen. You'll get others to listen. Of course, you can listen to William Craig then on Friday evening at 8 o'clock Pacific, 11 o'clock Eastern. I always enjoy William. He's certainly one of our favorite guests. Well, this is the time we need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And if you agree with us, we're involved in a spiritual battle. We do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And it's as simple as calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927 or 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are under attack from within today. And then, of course, we want to mention that certainly we, of course, represent Ready Reserve Foods, dehydrated foods, long-term food storage, and Ready Reserve Foods, you know, really, of course, has excellent products, but they're very hard to get now. We've been, for years, suggesting you lay in a supply of food, because food shortages are developing throughout the world, and I believe we're entering into a period of chaos and crisis. And so if you're going to lay in a supply of food, don't put it off. Right now, it's very difficult to fill the orders. We're getting them filled, but as quickly as we can, but there's usually a delay of several weeks because they're having a hard time getting food. Many things are in short supply. Some of the dairy products, some of the powdered eggs, some of the powdered milk and other things. It's hard sometimes even to get wheat. I mean, many things are in real short supply. Do not put it off. If you'd like a free catalog of the emergency food catalog, and it's not only emergency food, but all the other things you'll need, barrels, and certainly the pumps for getting the water out of the barrels. Of course, we do carry the Berkey water filters, so that you can get purified water. You'll have potable water if, for one reason or another, you can't get water to regular channels. Our number is 1-800-544-8927. We suggest that people lay in a supply of health products, of vitamins and minerals and herbs and other things that we carry. Allobiotic, which is a combination of oil of oregano and garlic and elderberry juice and a couple of other things that really do seem to help people when they come down with the flu or tend to avoid getting the flu. At least it works for our family. That, along with large doses of vitamin D, and they've kept us going on a daily basis here, while many of the people that we work with and people we know have been laid up for weeks at a time with the influenza. So if you'd like the health food product, the catalog, if you'd like the emergency food catalog or a regular catalog, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free newsletter, we'll send it to you. Of course, we really hope that you'll want to subscribe to the newsletter. We hope that you'll want to join the Radio Liberty family and help us as we reach out every day, 5 hours every day, and on then weekends we have almost 60 outlets around throughout the country on shortwave, internet, satellite radio stations. And we've got a fair number of radio stations. We pay for time on most of them. It's expensive, but we feel it's important to reach people and let them understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And so, again, Please remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Listen to our talk on the Forbidden Secret. Encourage your friends to listen to our program and at least get them to listen. Who knows? Perhaps it'll change their lives. Under any circumstances, we ask you to pray for America because this is truly a spiritual battle. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers who should be leading the battle, and then pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.